A production of South Dakota Public Broadcasting.
We'll call this meeting of House Judiciary to order and ask our secretary to please take the roll.
Representative Ingalls, Feinstein, Gibson, Gosch,
here.
Hamill, Hoffman,
here.
Killer, Lust,
I'm here, Madam Secretary.
Mosier,
here.
Schleckaway,
here.
Turbeville,
here.
Hunt,
here.
Cutler,
here.
Madam Chair, 9 of 13 are present.
Heather Page. Thank you, Madam Secretary. We do have a quorum present. Can you send a page? Okay. Hurry. Well, good morning, everyone, committee members. Welcome once again to House Judiciary. Welcome to our internet listeners. I'll ask the chair seeks approval of the prior minutes.
So moved.
Moved by Turbeville, seconded by Hoffman. Those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Are there any opposed? Our minutes are approved. Committee members, as you can see, we have some committee members already this morning that are pitching their bills in other committees, and we do need to maintain a quorum here, so if you do need to leave to go pitch a bill, please let me know where you are so we can get you back if we are stalled on a bill without enough members. Right now, I'm stalling a little bit, waiting for Representative Feinstein to get back to the committee. But it becomes a busy time, I know, for all of you, and I understand that you have to go take care of your bills too, but if we logistically can keep track of you, so if we need to send our pages after you, I would appreciate that. Our pages this morning are, if you would introduce yourself, please.
Ashley Schilling.
From?
Rapid City.
Rapid City. Ashley, welcome.
Abby,
thanks for your service to us this morning. I've already had you out there working. We appreciate that. Just a reminder to anyone wishing to testify, you need to sign in at the dais at the back. That is the official, helps prepare the official journal of the Judiciary Committee meetings and is important to the legislative history of the bills. And also a reminder of just procedurally how the testimony committing hearing procedurally is done in House committees. We, of course, first take proponent testimony, opponent testimony, rebuttal for the proponent if there is opponent testimony. Then we close to testimony and open to questions of the committee. So everyone knows that we do hold our questions until the end of the committee meeting. With that, we are open to House Bill 1101. We will open the hearing for House Bill 1101, which is an act to allow affidavits for change of judge in habeas corpus actions. With that, good morning, Representative Gosch.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members of the Judiciary Committee. I'm Brian Gosch, Representative, District 32, Rapid City. House Bill 1101, and by the way, I'm going to keep my comments brief and then turn it over to an expert in this area. I'll just briefly describe to you what the bill does. The first change in the bill was an LRC recommendation on a language choice. I didn't have a problem with that, changing except where to unless. And although this bill is short, the second change is more significant. I'll let the next proponent explain that. Crossing out habeas corpus, this is a bill which lists those types of proceedings where you can't recuse a judge. This would cross it out and allow you to recuse a judge in that case. So, with that, Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'll yield my time.
Thank you, Representative Gosch. Further proponent testimony for House Bill 1101.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, Chuck Schroyer on behalf of the State's Attorneys Association. This is a bill that came to the attention of the association at the request of Jesse Sondrial, who's the state's attorney in Meade County out in Sturgis. And he's here to explain this, but it's one that our board yesterday met in peer and we discussed this. It was one that hadn't gotten into our normal process for review, and our board unanimously agreed that we would support the bill and we'd urge your favorable consideration.
Thank you, Mr. Schreier. Further proponent testimony for House Bill 1101.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Jesse Sondrial, Meade County State's Attorney, Sturgis, South Dakota. Also current president of the South Dakota State's Attorneys Association.
Excuse me, do you represent the State's Attorneys Association in your testimony?
I believe Mr. Schroyer did represent their official position. I am just here in my capacity as Meade County State's Attorney. Thank you for that, Madam Chair. The genesis of House Bill 1101 occurred accidentally. After reviewing a panoply of statutes and case law, it became my opinion that the habeas corpus language that's contained in SDCL 1512-21 was an inadvertent inclusion into the final two words or three words of that statute. 1512-21 in part states that no affidavit for a change of judge may be filed in any proceeding for contempt committed in the presence of the court or habeas corpus. Those final three words are the language which we seek to redact from that. In all honesty, the bill really does nothing more to correct what I do perceive as a glaring oversight. By way of background, recusals, as the majority of this panel are attorneys, recusals are allowed in basically every criminal and civil proceeding. Habeas corpus cases arise challenging the constitutionality of an underlying criminal action, but technically are an independent civil filing. Now, who would benefit from this legislation? It's certainly my position that it only affords the rights otherwise extended in all other filings. It therefore would only promote continuity and avoid confusion. I am not aware of any opponent to this testimony. It would equally afford the same rights that have been previously afforded to statute to both prosecution and defendants. Further, there is no significant or tangible increase in costs that I'm aware of to the unified judicial system. I think it's also significant and important to recognize that this proposal will not result in any unnecessary delay because adequate safeguards have already been adopted. SDLC or SDCL 1512-24 in part says that the submission to a judge of argument or proof in support of a motion does waive your right to recusal. Moreover, 1512-27 sub 3 states in part that if there has been a prior disqualification, a second or subsequent disqualification must occur or shall occur within 2 days after receiving notice. As you can see, this will not result in unnecessary delay based on the safeguards and will only accomplish uniformity throughout the statutes. Based on the foregoing, I'd ask for your favorable consideration of House Bill 1101.
Thank you. Is there further proponent testimony for House Bill 1101? Seeing none, is there any opponent testimony? If not, we will close to proponent and opponent testimony and open to questions of the committee. Representative Lust.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a question for Mr. Sandrill. Mr. Sandrill, were you, in your research on this bill, were you able to uncover any information as to why habeas corpus was included in here originally?
Apologize to the Chair. I couldn't divine the intention. The last known entry appears to be in 1975. Maybe Mr. or Representative Ingalls could clue us in on the federal process or practice. I know he's familiar with that. In my review of states throughout the country, there appears to be a divide. Statutorily, it's allowed in a number of jurisdictions and not in another.
Thank you. Further questions of the committee? Seeing none, we will close to committee question. Is there a question of the committee? Representative Turbeville.
I apologize. You know, not being an attorney and but a big fan of Boston Legal, would someone please explain to me very, very quickly what habeas corpus is?
Thank you, Representative Turbeville, and I thank you for the question. I think for the sake of our internet audience and the people in the room, as well as all of those non-lawyers, I thank you for your question. I think, you know, don't ever hesitate, and that's just for all of our committee members who are non-lawyers. If we start using our legal terms and you're unfamiliar with them, we encourage your questions. Mr. Sandra.
After there has been a plea of guilty or conviction, Representative Turbeville, it's a collateral attack or a challenge on the constitutionality of the underlying proceedings, usually by way of an ineffective assistance of counsel claim. These cases tend to carry a life of their own and can go on for years after the the conclusion of the underlying criminal case.
Further questions of the committee? Seeing none, we'll close to committee questions and open to committee discussion and or action on House Bill 1101.
Madam Chair.
Representative Mosier.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Move to pass.
Move to pass by Mosier, seconded by Schlakoway. Remarks on that motion, Representative Mosier. Further discussion on the do pass motion on House Bill 1101? Seeing nothing, we'll vote on the do pass motion on House Bill 1101. Those in favor vote aye. Those opposed, no. The Secretary will please call the roll.
Representative Ingalls?
Aye.
Feinstein?
Aye.
Gibson? Gosch?
Aye.
Hamill? Hoffman?
Aye.
Killer? Lust?
Aye.
Mosier?
Aye.
Schlakoway?
Aye.
Turbeville?
Aye.
Hunt?
Aye.
Cutler?
Aye.
Madam Chair, 10 ayes, 3 excused.
Thank you, Madam Secretary. House Bill 1101 goes to the floor. Do pass. Representative Gosch.
Would it be appropriate at this time for me to move House Bill 1246 be next on the Judiciary Committee calendar?
You don't actually have to move that. That will be at the deference of the chair. Is there any further action on House Bill 1101? Representative Ingalls.
Second.
Moved consent by Ingalls, seconded by Hoffman. Thank you. Valiant effort, Representative Ingalls. But Representative Lust objects, so it will not go on the consent calendar. However, it does go to the floor, do pass with unanimous recommendation. With that, Representative Gosch, we'll move in the calendar to House Bill 1246. House Bill 1246, which is an act to revise certain provisions relating to service of garnishee summons, affidavit, and garnishment disclosure. We are open to proponent testimony on House Bill 1246.
Good morning again, Madam Chair and members of the Judiciary Committee. I'm Representative Brian Gosch, District 32. And I appreciate the indulgence of the chair in allowing me to bring this bill next, since I have another bill up in Commerce, so I really appreciate that. House Bill 1246 is meant to bring fairness to the process of providing notice to defendants and garnishees in a garnishment action. For those of you not familiar with garnishment actions, it's kind of important to lay out the players. First, you have the garnishor, or more commonly known as the plaintiff, and that's the person who has obtained a money judgment against the defendant in a previous court action. Then you have the garnishee. The garnishee is not the person against whom the judgment has been obtained. The garnishee is usually the employer of the defendant and is the person who needs to be made aware of the amount that needs to be withheld from the defendant's paycheck. The last party to the action is the defendant against whom a judgment has currently been taken and against whom a wage garnishment has been started. Currently, in garnishment actions, a plaintiff or judgment creditor must follow a few steps when trying to serve a garnishment action on the defendant. The plaintiff, according to SDCL 21-18-10 and 21-18-11, must serve the garnishee summons and affidavit on the garnishee. Then, within 30 days, the plaintiff must personally serve, or serve by certified mail, the garnishee summons, affidavit, and garnishment disclosure on the defendant. The problem exists here at this point because, knowing that a judgment against them exists, a defendant is able to avoid service by avoiding a sheriff's service and by not signing the certified letters they receive. Both situations tend to happen too often. This bill would allow a plaintiff who has been reasonably diligent in trying to obtain service on a defendant to perfect their service by sending all the documents to the defendant by certified mail. In order to make this process work, we also need an amendment to remove the last line of SDCL 21-18-10. This portion of the statute makes a failure to get these documents served on the defendant within 30 days from the service on the garnishee void service. Without this amendment, we are locked in an endless cycle of service upon the employer and searching for the defendant. That cycle is costly, inefficient, and overly burdensome on plaintiffs. Therefore, I would request your support on House Bill 1246. And there should be an amendment, and I consider it a friendly one, of course. So, thank you.
Thank you, Representative Gosch. Further proponent testimony for House Bill 1246.
Good morning,
Madam Chairman.
Good morning.
Greg Adamson, committee. Greg Adamson, I'm with the South Dakota Collectors Association. I am their legislative chairman. That title represents no value as far as money goes. This is a volunteer position. I'm here because I've been appointed to do this. I've been a lobbyist on and off for them for about the last 20 years. So I've worked on a number of garnishment issues. We are an association of debt collectors across the state of South Dakota that carry sales tax licenses. We represent thousands of businesses across the state. We represent individuals. We represent city governments. We represent county governments. And we even have contracts with the state of South Dakota state government to collect debts. So we are the last straw in the line of producing revenue for people that have past due accounts. Today, my objective is to get the committee to agree to allowing certified mail for process in, as the last straw. What I've got today is a mock garnishment situation that Representative Schleckaway let me use his name in a mock garnishment situation. And I think it's important that you kind of understand garnishment before you're able to make a decision on that. Of course, the lawyers most likely would have a good idea of what this process is, but some of the lay people would not be familiar. If you would, Madam Chairman, I'd like to distribute some materials.
Certainly the pages will help distribute your materials.
If I may proceed, Madam Chairman.
Please.
Okay. What you have before you is a mock garnishment action that I initiated, and the judgment creditor is Todd Schleckaway, and the debtor is Greg Adamson. Let's say Todd was driving down the street, and I was at the stop sign, and I from another direction, and I pulled out and I hit him, and I damaged his car, and I had no insurance. And he has an insurance policy that only pays if he's at fault. So his insurance says, well, go after Greg and get the money, and if you don't, we'll talk. So he calls me and says, Greg, you know, I got the estimate. It's $3,500. I'd like to have you write me out a check for that. And I said, I don't think I'm going to pay you, Todd. And he says, well, gee, you know, you did. If you don't, I'm going to take you to small claims court, or I'm going to take you to circuit court and hire an attorney. And he said, I said, well, go ahead, do whatever you have to do. Well, Todd goes ahead and he sues me in small claims court. He gets a judgment. That would be 1A on your number listing there. And he gets a judgment for $3,500 against me. He calls me after he gets a judgment and says, Greg, you know, I need you to pay me because you hit my car and I've got a judgment against you and you're liable. And I said, well, do whatever you have to do, Todd. So he goes and sees Brian, and Brian says, well, I know Greg has a good job at credit collection services. Let's go after his paycheck. So he hires Brian to prepare a garnishment, and Brian prepares the garnishment, which is 1B, and they go after my wages. And as you can see by 1B, 1C is the garnishment itself. It's a 60-day continuing lien. It's only a lien on wages for 60 days, and then it ends. D, excuse me, 1D is an actual application for taxation of cost that goes with it, and a certificate of service is 1E. 1F is a garnishment disclosure that goes to the employer, and that the employer fills out as far as a formula for the garnishment. And so Todd says, well, I'm going to do a garnishment action against you, and he has Brian prepare the papers, and Brian sends the papers out certified mail, of which would look like this. It has a return receipt with dual numbers. It has my address here, and or you do the same thing with the employer. On the back side, you have what they call a return receipt, so that you know that the employer got this garnishment, and that also that Greg Adamson got it, that he got served. So this process goes on, and the post office attempts delivery for 14 days. And if I don't sign the back of that card in 14 days, then I'll get this letter back from the 15th day to the 17th day from the post office unserved. Well, then it comes back to Brian.
Excuse me, Mr. Adamson. I hate to quibble with you, but I do ask that while the committee members are at the bench that you refer to them by their surnames.
I'm sorry.
Thank you.
Yes. Representative Gosh takes and serves this, takes it to the sheriff at that point, and has the sheriff attempt service on me. Well, the sheriff pulls up my driveway, and I see him pull up, and I hide, and he knocks on the door, and he knocks on the door, and he knocks on the door, and I don't answer the door. He comes back the next day. This goes on for 3 or 4 or 5 days, and I know it's the sheriff, and I'm not answering the door. So we go the 30th day, and the sheriff doesn't service, but he actually gets service on the 31st day. Now that's not legal service, because this summons had to be served within 30 days on me. I've got an instance right here in my hands that the employer was withholding on the garnishment, and he had an amount of about $600 in 60 days. So the guy made pretty good money. In order to get a release of those funds from an employer, you have to have a motion and order, or most people request a motion and order, and that's an order that is signed by the judge that has reviewed these documentations that we have given to them, from the garnishment process to the judgment to the motion order, and would sign an affidavit in support of a motion or sign the order itself. And the order would tell the employer to release said funds that they've got in their possession to the plaintiff, which would be Todd Schleckaway, Representative Schleckaway, excuse me. And at that point, things would be taken care of. Now, if I don't get service, the judge looks at that and says, well, I'm sorry, I can't sign a motion and order because Greg Adamson wasn't served those papers within 30 days. And at that point, the whole garnishment process is voided. The employer is commanded by the court to release those funds back to the employee, which would be myself. So here Todd is, used his college, Representative Schleckaway,
yes,
used his money to fix his car, and I didn't reimburse him. And now it's costing more money to do this whole process, and he got nothing. What we're saying is this bill would propose to, within that 30-day period, if I did the certified mail, if I had Representative Schleckaway due diligence, did the certified mail, did the sheriff's service, and did not get service, within that 30-day period, he would send to my home address a registered mail that would allow for him to be considered served, or me to be considered served. And that all that is a mailing of the garnishment and the disclosure to the defendant in this action, and it would be considered served by that process itself. So that way people don't go through this entire process and are voided just because a debtor doesn't want to get served and makes an attempt to avoid service. And with that, I would answer any questions. I would also like to get these handouts back if possible.
Certainly.
Okay.
We'll have the pages pick up the handouts. Thank you, Mr. Adamson.
Thank you.
Is there further proponent testimony for House Bill 1246?
Madam Chairman.
Mr. Adamson.
The Retailers Association is in support of this bill also. Excuse me.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. Any further proponent testimony for House Bill 1246? If not, we'll close to proponent testimony and open to opponent testimony. Is there opponent testimony for House Bill 1246? Seeing none, we'll close to proponent and opponent testimony and open to questions of the committee. Representative Lust. Was thirsty.
Thank you,
this
Madam,
morning.
Madam Chair. I have a question for either of the proponents. My question is on line 9 on page 1 of the bill. And I don't think you need to read it. I'll clarify. It says the plaintiff may file an affidavit. Regarding filing, that it would be filed in the garnishment action, not the underlying action, correct?
Mr. Adamson.
That would be filed with the garnishment action itself. That's correct.
Okay. Right. Thank you.
Yeah. Other questions of the committee? Yes, I have a question for Representative Gosch. On line 8, you don't have to go. You can answer the questions from there if you prefer. On line 8, the term reasonable diligence, I'm wondering if that has a definition or if it's used as a standard anywhere else in this area of the law.
Thank you, Madam Chair, for that question. I might have to defer to someone else for that question. I am not sure.
That's fine. If anybody else would like to answer the question.
Madam Chairman, Drew Duncan. I'm a lawyer from Sioux Falls, registered lobbyist for the South Dakota Collectors Association. I signed in on this bill, but for sake of judicial economy and legislative economy, I didn't come up and provide any comments on the bill. But
we do appreciate that. And are you signed in as a proponent?
I am signed in as a proponent, and I will switch from do I wish to testify no to yes.
Thank you.
I don't believe I will preface my comments by saying I drafted the bill before we passed the bill on to Ruben for his good work. I actually did look the definitions of both due diligence and reasonable diligence. I don't think the term, at least in this section, do not believe the term reasonable diligence is defined. It's not defined anywhere else. And I would need to go back and look again before I give you a for sure answer, but I don't think reasonable diligence is defined anywhere else in the code either.
My own follow-up to that question then is, are you aware if that term is used anywhere else in this area of law? Is it a term that we use in talking about garnishments and such?
Madam Chair, I do not believe that it is.
Thank you. Other questions of the committee? Representative Hoffman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I do have a question for Mr. Duncan. I'm sitting in the same chair as Representative Turbeville in this matter. Intelligence gently blowing in the wind, and I'm hoping to catch a little breeze. Anyway, does this matter work in state and out of state? Can you go after someone with this procedure that moved out of state, left the state, moved anywhere else, sir? Thank you.
Mr. Duncan.
Madam Chairman, if you can get that breeze to blow over this way, I'd appreciate that as well. And I don't mean to be cute, but maybe I do. I don't know. I believe, Representative Hoffman, that if you were to do that you would have to follow the procedure set by that state for the execution on a garnishment. For instance, I would believe that if I was looking to start a garnishment action against someone in the state of, let's say, Nebraska, that I would have to follow the laws of the state of Nebraska for that garnishment action.
Thank you. Further questions of the committee? One more question from me, Mr. Duncan. What activities would you associate then with the term reasonable diligence?
Madam Chairman, I was talking about this with Representative Gosch right before the committee hearing, and I would maybe turn that question a little bit to what I'm going to call the three checks. reasonable diligence on the three checks would be, one, you notified the person that you had a judgment against them, and that wouldn't be in this action, but they were on notice that they had a judgment against them. Two, you attempted by both personal service by sheriff or other, or you know, professional service server, or certified mail. Three, they would be on notice from their employer when their wages started to be garnished. Reasonable diligence would be decided by a court, I believe, if a judge was to believe that, you know, if you couldn't prove in your affidavit, which you're forced to draft by this amendment, excuse me, by this change involved in 1246, if a judge didn't believe that you, you know, were correctly following certified mail or, you know, half-heartedly tried to get a, maybe just sent a, on the 29th day, just sent someone out there, a professional service server on the 29th day only one time, I do not believe that would be reasonable diligence, and I think that decision ultimately would be up to a court.
Thank you. Are there further questions of the committee? Seeing none, we'll close to committee questions and open to committee discussion and or action on House Bill 1246.
Madam Chair.
Representative Lust.
I have an amendment.
Please state your amendment.
I will. Can I have it distributed?
Please. Representative Lust has distributed 1246-RA.
That's correct, Madam Chair.
Is there a second?
Second.
Seconded by Representative Hunt. Remarks on that motion, Representative Lust.
If you look at the amendment, the first amendment beginning on page 2, line 1, the purpose of that paragraph and the underscored language is to confirm that the garnishee basically is exonerated from the process of it if it follows statutory language. It's just another safeguard to make sure the garnishee, which is in most cases going to be the employer, is not on the hook for anything due to the changes we're making here. And the Section 2 change identified below where it was alluded to by Representative Gosh, striking the last sentence in 21.18.10 is necessary, again, so we don't get in a cycle where this continues to repeat itself. And I think by complying with the new change in the law, you're exonerated rather than having to comply with the last sentence of 21.18.10.
Remarks on the Lust motion to amend. Seeing none, those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Are there any opposed? That motion carries, and we are back to House Bill 1246 as amended. Representative Gosh.
Madam Chair, thank you. I move we send House Bill 1264 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Second.
Representative Gosh, I believe you mean 1246.
I apologize, Madam Chair. I had the next bill up. Yes, House Bill 1246. Thank you.
Moved by Gosh, seconded by Hoffman. Remarks on that motion, Representative Gosh.
Let me see if I have my remarks straight. Make sure I'm not remarking on that other bill.
I'm sure Representative Turbeville will let you know if you don't.
I appreciate him keeping me in line over here.
We do too.
I've been on both sides of cases like this. I've represented both interests. And I think this is a good change in the law. And I think the lawyers already know, but I think the other committee members could also know that there are protections in the law that don't allow a garnisher to take all of the defendant's wages. It would be 40 times the federal minimum wage is protected. So the current law and this change would not, this change in the law would not stop any of that. The defendant would still have those protections, and a certain amount of minimum wages would still be going to the defendant and not be subject to garnishment by the garnisher.
Thank you, Representative Gosh. Further remarks or comment on the Gosh motion do pass on House Bill as amended on House Bill 1246. Representative Feinstein.
Thank you. Mine is more technical in nature, and it's just it's a question. I mean, I believe we're headed the right way. I am just a little bit concerned with certified mail, registered mail. I understand what we're trying to do here, but to me, certified does the same thing. When I go to the U.S. Postal Service website, all that registered mail does is literally ensures the letter for a value, a dollar value, and it's a secured way. It goes from box to box and lockbox to lockbox, and I'm trying to understand why. Are just in the whole concept of garnishments, why the certified mail doesn't take care of the problem from the start, and why we then go to a registered mail, because again, I can't put my arms around that, and I need help with that.
Representative Lust.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, Representative Feinstein, essentially what this change does is it allows it's a tip of the hat to the defendant saying, we haven't been able to get a hold of you through certified mail, which is usually a prescribed method. Therefore, we are going to make another effort through regular mail, and then our obligation to notify you is done. Our obligation can't be completed through certified mail if you don't ever get it. So we're saying, listen, we've tried a couple options. You haven't been notified. And actually, that's not even accurate, because you will have been notified once your wages are being garnished. But we're at least giving them a nod saying, as far as the plaintiff goes, our obligation to get a hold of you is complete once we drop it in the mail. It allows the process to move forward. Otherwise, you have a roadblock and you have not complied with law.
Further questions or comment of the committee? Representative Ingalls.
Whenever you put registered mail into a statute, certified mail can be sent instead. There's another statute, SDCL 17-4-1, that says certified mail is the equivalent of registered mail. Whenever any law requires service, mailing, transmittal, blah, blah, by registered mail, it shall be sufficient compliance with such law if it's mailed by certified. So just putting registered in there.
Further discussion of the committee? If not, we will. Representative Shockway.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to comment. This is an issue that, you know, I have received quite a bit of communication on from folks in Sioux Falls, and I think the change is needed. I think this is a positive change. I'm supporting it.
Further discussion by the committee?
Madam Chair.
Representative Mosier.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Very briefly, but I just wanted to suggest that we heard a lot of complex testimony here that might be difficult to replicate on the floor, so when appropriate, I would suggest that we move this to the consent calendar if it's appropriate.
That's not exactly a good pitch for the consent calendar, Representative Mosier, but fine effort. Is there anything further on House Bill 1246 as amended? If not, the motion is due pass as amended. The secretary will please call the roll. Those in favor will say aye. Those opposed, no.
Representative Ingalls?
No.
Feinstein?
I'm going to pass.
Gibson? Gosch?
Aye.
Hamill? Hoffman?
Aye.
Killer? Lust?
Aye.
Mosier?
Aye.
Schleckaway?
Aye.
Turbeville?
Aye.
Hunt?
Aye.
Cutler?
Aye.
Feinstein?
I'll come back and say aye.
Thank you. 9 ayes, 1 no, 3 excused.
Thank you, Madam Secretary. And House Bill 1246 goes to the floor, due pass as amended. With that, we'll move in the calendar to House Bill 1245. House Bill 1245 is an act to provide certain protections to governmental employees who report certain violations or suspected violations of law. With that, we are open to proponent testimony on House Bill 1245. Representative Ingalls.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm Representative Rich Ingalls from Hartford, District 9. And I bring today House Bill 1245, an act to provide certain protections to governmental employees who report certain violations or suspected violations of law. Basically what this is, you could call it if you will, it's a whistleblower law. It prohibits government. It applies only to government, whether it be state or any subdivision of the state, from penalizing, firing, cutting wages, any of those sort of things, to anybody who either reports a law violation to authorities or who refuses to participate in illegal activity. Many other states, although I don't know the exact number, many other states have such laws that apply not only to public employees but also to people in the private sector. This law is far more narrowly drawn. It applies only to governmental employees. In fact, it's modeled after Michigan and Illinois, that bastion of good government. But Illinois does actually have a similar law that's even broader than this. But the Michigan law, the Illinois law, have both been in place for 20-plus years. I'm not suggesting that there's a whole lot of criminal activity going on, that there's a whole lot of retaliation going on, but this is a framework to deal with the issue if the issue should come up. And I truly believe that it's good public policy to protect people who come forward and disclose any kind of illegal activity perpetrated by government. So that's my intent here, and I would stand by for any questions.
Thank you, Representative Ingalls. Further proponent testimony for House Bill 1245. Seeing none, is there any opponent testimony to House Bill 1245? Good morning.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Lynn Valenti, Attorney, Bureau of Personnel. Let me begin my comments by saying that the Bureau of Personnel is not opposed to a whistleblower law per se, but we cannot support HB 1245 for several reasons. First, the bill only applies to state and political subdivision employers. Therefore, if the bill were to pass, the majority of South Dakota citizens would receive no benefit from this law. Also, we don't believe this law is necessary. Section 2 provides that no employer may discharge, threaten, or otherwise discriminate against an employee because the employee or a person acting on their behalf reports or is about to report verbally or in writing a violation or a suspected violation of law. There already exists in federal and state law, rule, and policy various whistleblower protections, some specific to state employees and some more general. The majority of state employees are career service employees, and under the Career Service Act, in order to discipline a career service employee, you have to have just cause to discipline, and just cause is defined in rule. Also, under the Career Service Act, specifically, SDCL 36A52 provides a grievance mechanism for employees who believe they've been retaliated against for reporting a violation of state law. Now, there are state employees that are not career service, and they are exempt or at-will employees. However, these at-will employees are also protected from retaliation for reporting violations of law. Our state Supreme Court has recognized a public policy exception to the at-will employment doctrine, and this exception allows an at-will employee to bring a contract action for wrongful discharge when the employer discharges the employee for their refusal to commit a crime or an unlawful act, as well as for those who report an alleged unlawful act by the employer. And again, there are also various state and federal laws, you know, the Civil Rights Act of 1964, the Family and Medical Leave Act, the FLSA, Fair Labor Standards Act, the Equal Pay Act, there's OSHA statutes, workers' comp statutes. There's many statutes out there that provide protection for employees on the basis of retaliation for reporting. Section 2 of the bill provides that a state or public employer may not discharge an employee because the employee or the person acting on their behalf reports or is about to report a violation, but nowhere in this bill is defined what about to report means, and I wonder what that means. Is that a day? Is that a week? A month? 6 months? I just don't know. Also, Section 4 of the bill allows any person who alleges a violation of the Act to bring a civil action for injunctive relief or damages, but there's no requirement in the bill for exhaustion of administrative remedies, and we believe that this will allow the persons to skip that administrative process, and we believe that many of these employees would have that process available to them and go straight to court. And this will discourage employees from resolving complaints at the lowest possible level, as well as be very costly to defend. Section 6 of the bill authorizes the court to award the costs of litigation, including attorney fees, to the complainant, but not the employer. This is unfair and provides no incentive to discourage frivolous litigation. These cases are expensive and they're time-consuming to defend, and this provision places an unfair burden on the employer. Again, let me, and there are other things with the bill, but I won't go through it that we have concerns with for brevity's sake. But let me again conclude my testimony, Madam Chair, by saying that, again, the Bureau is not opposed to a general whistleblower law, but opposed to this bill in particular. And for those reasons, I would ask that you vote no on HB 1245, and I would stand by at the appropriate time for questions.
Thank you. Is there further opponent testimony to House Bill 1245?
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Yvonne Taylor with the South Dakota Municipal League. Don't want to be repetitive, but we would echo the sentiments from the Bureau of Personnel. We, too, would have no objection to a whistleblower or protection, but feel this bill is just not the way to do it. So we would urge your defeat. Thank you.
Thank you. Further opponent testimony to House Bill 1245? Seeing none, we'll close to opponent testimony and allow Representative Ingalls rebuttal.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll go through the objections in turn. The first one, I believe, was it only applies to government employees. That's true. It's more narrowly tailored than the laws in a lot of other states. My thought was that if we bring it to apply to everybody, well, then we get a whole bunch of other opponents in here. But government employees are what we really have control over here. We don't necessarily have control over private employers. So this is a very limited bill, and it's intended to be a very limited bill. It was mentioned that career service employees are covered. Well, they may be, they may not be. State law does have some procedural protections allowing state employees to have a hearing if they believe they've been wrongfully retaliated against. But those are procedural protections. There's no substantive protections in the law, and that's what this is intended to be. And the difference is procedure means that you could have a hearing, but there's no underlying principles to guide what happens at the hearing. And that's what this is. This is a substantive protection that would be applied when the procedural protection, the hearing, comes up. There were a whole bunch of red herrings thrown out about family, medical leave, work comp, OSHA, all these other things have protections. No, those aren't protections for whistleblowers. OSHA, those really have nothing to do with this, really have nothing to do with this. It was mentioned there's a Supreme Court decision, but obviously there was nothing cited. There was no cite given. And I would certainly question that because it was never mentioned to me and there's no cite that was given. Question was raised about the language about to report. Well, obviously that would be that would have to be determined by the court or the administrative agency whether a person was about to report. That's a question of fact, and questions of fact come up in each and every case that ever occurs. That's what has to be established, the facts. It was brought up Section 4 provides for a civil action and may not require exhaustion of administrative remedies. That may be a valid concern. We do have an administrative process in place, and we expect people to follow the administrative process. So maybe that should be changed. That's possibly a valid concern. In certain cases, I shouldn't say that's a valid concern in every case, because you would go to the circuit court to get an injunction. That's the only place you would get an injunction. An injunction is the circuit court. You wouldn't go through an administrative agency for an injunction, because you're asking the circuit court to prohibit the government agency from taking action. So that's something where you would not need to exhaust administrative remedies. You would go straight to circuit court. So I could see that there might be a little bit of change that would be needed for that. My suggestion on that would be simply to say, I may bring a civil action for an appropriate injunctive relief, and any other damages sought, you would have to go through the administrative process first and exhaust administrative remedies. So I could see where the civil action might be limited to an injunction. So that's an appropriate concern that was brought up. Question was raised about why it would award attorney fees to an employer or to a person who had complained, but not to the employer. Well, think about that for a moment. There would only be this cause of action would only be brought if a person could establish up front that they have reported or were about to report a criminal violation, a violation of law, well, not necessarily criminal, violation of the law. So how would the employer ever, the employer who is violating the law, ever be entitled to attorney fees? It's just simply not applicable. And, I'd be happy to answer any further questions, but a lot of the thoughts that were put out here are really red herrings, I think. This is a very limited bill, far more limited than a lot of other states have, and other states have had these for 20-plus years. So I would suggest that it's about time for South Dakota to have one of these laws. I would also say just briefly that the opponents have said, well, we don't have any problem with the whistleblower law. We just don't like this. Well, nobody came to work with me on this. Nobody ever suggested here's the language we should have. So one thing to consider.
With that, we are closed to proponent and opponent testimony and open to questions of the committee. Representative Lust.
Is it just habit, or do you always look at me when you ask if there are any questions?
I'll plead the fifth on that.
I do have some questions, Madam Chair.
I thought you might.
For Representative Ingalls. My first question for you, Representative Ingalls, is concerns Section 5 of the bill. And my question is, I want to make sure, so the prima facie case need to be shown by a terminated employee would be that he or she was about to report a violation. Is that correct?
Representative Ingalls.
Yes, and perhaps that should say had reported or was about to report.
Okay.
Follow-up, Representative Lust.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Is there no requirement that the employee needs to show that the employer knew that this report was about to be filed or had been filed?
Representative Ingalls.
That's a good point. That's a good point. Perhaps that should be in there.
One further question.
Further questions, Representative Lust.
I want to give you an opportunity to clarify some of the opposition testimony. I believe that the opposition testimony indicated that this would only apply to at-will government employees because employees who are essentially under contract, there needs to be just cause shown for their termination. Is that correct?
This would apply to any government employees, whether they're career service, at-will employees, or if you look at the definition of employee on, in Section 1, anybody with a contract with the governmental entity. So if the contract were terminated.
Okay. Thank you.
Further questions of the committee? If there are none, we will close to committee questions and open to committee discussion and or action on House Bill 1245. Representative Lust.
I hate to be the bad guy here, but I would move we defer this to the 41st day.
Second. Moved by Lust, seconded by Turbeville. Remarks on that motion, Representative Lust.
Well, as my questions indicated, I have some concerns about an employee who's terminated being able simply to raise a case for being wrongfully terminated simply by saying, "Oh, I was about to raise a legal violation." That would lead me to, if I were an employee, all I would do is have a letter in my file that said, "I know my employer violated this law," and I just put it in my file, and then when I'm terminated, I could simply just pull it out and say, "Hey, I had this in my file," and that would be that would meet the elements of this bill. So, you know, you hear the phrase, it's well-intentioned, and it is well-intentioned, but I think there's some things that need to be fleshed out in here, and I don't think we should do it on the fly. It's something that needs to take probably some cooperation between Representative Ingalls and the opponents to maybe bring back at another time, but I think it's premature in its current state. Thank you.
Representative Ingalls.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, I guess I would have to agree with Representative Lust. As I mentioned, this is adapted from some other states, and there are some valid issues that have been brought up by the opponents and the committee. And, you know, nobody ever wants to kill their own bill voluntarily, but maybe it's appropriate at this time and then come back next year with another bill, because there are some concerns, and it's better not to try to amend it on the fly.
Thank you, Representative Ingalls. Further discussion on the Lust motion to the 41st day on House Bill 1245. Representative Lust.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I think that, you know, the manner in which Representative Ingalls handles this is a lesson to us all as legislators and a little humility. And that is a good lesson. And I hope it's well learned. I mean, we all sometimes get a hold of an issue and want to push it forward. And I commend Representative Ingalls for recognizing that. And I think it takes a lot of, it does take a lot of humility and to admit that. And I appreciate that, Representative Ingalls. Thank you.
Further discussion of the committee. Representative Hoffman.
Madam Chair, today is a great example of why I have just the utmost respect for Representative Ingalls. Thank you.
Anything further of the committee? If not, we'll vote on the Lust motion to the 41st day on House Bill 1245. The secretary will please call the roll. Those in favor will vote aye. Those opposed, no.
Representative Ingalls.
Aye.
Feinstein.
Aye.
Gibson. Gosch, Hamill, Hoffman?
Aye.
Keller? Lust?
Aye.
Mosher?
Aye.
Schleckaway?
Aye.
Turbeville?
Aye.
Hunt?
Aye.
Cutler?
Aye.
Madam Chair, 9 ayes, 4 excused.
And House Bill 1245 is deferred to the 41st day. At this point, the chair will defer House Bill 1264 to February 20th, Friday, February 20th, House Bill 1264. With that, we drop below the line to a bill that has had prior hearing. And for those bills that do drop below the line that have had prior hearing, we have limited further testimony. If there is any testimony by anyone who couldn't appear earlier, we certainly would allow that, Representative Feinstein. If not, we'll be closed to proponent and opponent testimony and open to action on House Bill 1220.
Madam Chair, I would respectfully request that we defer this. We have four members of the committee that aren't here, and I just think I think we need the input of all the of more members, and I guess I would request, and I don't know if it's a motion to defer to Wednesday. I just think it's fair.
You have that right to make that motion.
Okay, I so move. Defer to Wednesday the...
Second. Moved by Feinstein, seconded by Ingalls. Remarks on that motion, Representative Feinstein.
Well, again, Madam Chair, this committee is made up of 13 people, and right now there are four missing, and I just think it deserves the full action of more members of the committee.
I'm going to ask that the committee resist the motion to defer simply because we are nearing crossover day. We have held this bill over, so I think the committee members have had a lot of time to think and discuss, and we haven't stopped voting on any other bill that was before us this morning. So with that, we have the Feinstein motion to defer. Representative Feinstein.
I guess one other comment. I mean, Representative Gosch is now testifying in another committee. Representative Gibson is gone because of the death of her mother. I just think these are not normal circumstances. It's not like somebody stepped out sick, decided not to show up today, and that's why.
Thank you, Representative Feinstein. We'll vote on the Feinstein motion to defer. The secretary will please call the roll. Those in favor say aye. Those opposed, no.
Representative Ingalls?
Aye.
Feinstein?
Aye.
Gibson? Gosch? Hamel? Hoffman?
Pass.
Killer? Lust?
No.
Mosier?
No.
Schleckaway?
No.
Turbeville?
No.
Hunt?
No.
Cutler?
No.
Representative Hoffman?
No.
Two ayes, four excused. Seven noes.
That motion fails. We are back to House Bill 1220. Representative Feinstein, do you have anything further on House Bill 1220?
I guess we really haven't debated it among the committee. We ended with the questions of the committee of the proponents and opponents, and I guess I think I believe some others want to speak to this, and I believe we should pass this motion, pass this bill, and I'll let others go for me first.
We do have a significant amount of time left in the committee hearing, Representative Feinstein. The committee, I'm perfectly fine with the time that we have left to allow any discussion from committee members by yourself and or others.
Well, through Madam Chair, I'll reserve and speak at the end.
Certainly. Further discussion on House Bill 1220, Representative Lust.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, I'm in favor of this bill, and the reasons are pretty simple. One, I asked some of the proponents of the bill if there is another defense available right now under this, under our current statute. You can, if you've been stopped in one of these circumstances where a light failed, a traffic safety or direction device failed, you have the ability to raise the defense that it was malfunctioning. Now, these traffic devices, their only purpose is to direct traffic. So, by definition, if it hasn't triggered a motorcycle or a car, it has failed that function, and that is a malfunction. I think that is a valid defense. I didn't find any evidence at all that someone was denied that offense or even raised that defense in a circumstance and it failed. So absent having attested the existing law, I see no reason why we need to create a new one to create a problem that probably doesn't exist. And therefore, I think this bill should not pass to the floor and should be killed.
Representative Hoffman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This bill I've done a couple different 180s on, and I've driven a motorcycle 4 years, a Maxim 1100, of which I own the speed record from Aberdeen to Eureka at midnight on a full moon, which is something we used to do, but I will never do again. That said, I've been in Aberdeen on a motorcycle and at exactly one of these things, not knowing why I didn't have the signal turning for me. A car came up behind me, it turned left, and I turned. So I understand the process and the problem with that process. But here's the real deal, and I'm going to say this publicly. When we have an enormous amount of policemen around the country who email me, sheriffs, policemen, and say, the problem with this, and I've talked to a few attorneys, which are easy to get a hold of in this place. what's going to happen? The collateral damage is what I was taught right away when I came to this great body. Always make sure the collateral damage is not greater than the lack of harm by passing the bill. What I think we're going to see is a number of people fighting stop sign, stop light violations, stop light violations, for the simple reason of giving a little grunt into the penal system that they've had past problems with solving in their favor, and taking every violation to court, making the law officer giving the ticket, making an attorney being present, just really dumbing down the law process. Therefore, I think we're going to create more harm by this than good. And as much as I can understand a few problems, I don't think it's a big enough problem today with the few problems that I've heard other people have at these intersections of passing a law giving them free rein to blow reds. So I'm going to have to vote against it. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Welcome back to the committee, Representative Hamill. We are on House Bill 1220, which is below the line, and I think you were present for the other committee hearings that we've held on 1220. Representative Ingalls.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, I don't think I've ever seen a more powerful lineup of proponents for a bill than what we saw here, and nobody was getting paid to be here. We had a former Attorney General of South Dakota testifying as a private citizen for this bill. We had a former Highway Patrol captain testifying as a private citizen in favor of this bill. Their motorcycles, this has happened to them, it's happened to me. Everybody should understand that there's a problem, that lights do not always register a motorcycle sitting there. And you can get cars sitting behind you that want to honk their horn, and they get mad at you because the light's not changing, and they blame you. The cars know what the problem is, too. Motorcyclists know what the problem is. Cars know what the problem is. But should somebody get a ticket for that? The law that we have on the books right now may or may not provide a complete a good affirmative defense. The law we have right now does not say it's an affirmative defense. It says if the light is malfunctioning. It's up to a judge to determine whether a light that is working is malfunctioning. You know, we're talking about lights that aren't down. We're talking about lights that are working the way they're designed to work. But we heard that we heard from Mr. Fahey that they haven't been set to register every vehicle, every motorcycle. Or if you're in between the plates, they might not pick it up. So the light is actually functioning properly, arguably. It's just not picking up the motorcycle. And this bill would fills that loophole. It gives that person the opportunity to say, well, the light might have been functioning. You know, it was working. It was changing for other people, but it wasn't changing for me. And this is my defense. I don't believe the sky is falling. The former Attorney General, the former Highway Patrol Captain have just as much interest as you and I in seeing to it that the laws are enforceable and that law enforcement isn't harmed by what we do here. They didn't have a problem with this bill. I don't think it'll cause problems for police officers. If this passes, police officers will continue to write tickets the same as they always have. It's just that people on a motorcycle will have a defense to those, and a specific defense that they could point to in law. So I think we should pass it.
Further discussion on House Bill 1220. Representative Gosch.
Madam Chair, I apologize for not being in here for the whole discussion. I hope I don't repeat anything anybody said. And this is no disrespect to Captain Fahey, but we had an all-star list of proponents on this bill, and I think it'd be hard to vote no on it. Thank you.
Further discussion on House Bill 1220, Representative Schleckway.
Thank you, Madam Chair. When the gentleman from Abate testified, Larry Nielsen, what caught my attention is the list he handed out. Most of those intersections, a lot of those, four or five of them, were in my district, you know, on Marion Road. And so it clearly is an issue, you know, and that was demonstrated. So I personally have struggled with this. I've talked to Representative Feinstein numerous times since the bill was first brought forward to us. For some reason, I just can't get out of my head what constitutes unreasonable time. That is different for each and every person, and I know every motorcyclist is going to use discretion in that, but I'm having trouble getting that part of the statute out of my mind.
Further discussion on House Bill 1220. Representative Lust.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think something Representative Ingalls said I made my case very well. He indicated that the existing statute may or may not work as a defense. And we're really not here talking about the failure of a traffic device. We're talking about the failure of a statute, which may or may not work as a defense. And the fact that it has not been apparently tried, the existing statute as a defense, to me, means there's no issue. If the proponents of this come back next year and say, in the intervening year, we've attempted that defense and it has failed three, four, one time, then they have some basis for bringing this bill. Right now, there's no basis. We have no idea if the existing statutory structure works or doesn't work. And until we have that evidence, I see no reason why we should go about creating new laws.
Further discussion on House Bill 1220. Representative Feinstein.
Thank you, and maybe this will be the last word. Maybe not. Anyway, again, I am not a writer. I'm bringing it as part of a constituent from District 14 who had a concern, who didn't want to go and break the law. He didn't know that law was there would be a defense for him. And until I actually first presented this bill to my colleague to the right of me, he's the one that actually pointed out this law to law enforcement. He pointed this out. Nobody really knew it existed. Nobody even felt that would be a defense, and they've been ticketing people. Again, law enforcement on one side in the city says it's a loophole. Those on the other side said a judge will throw it out. But that's another problem. If, my friend from Loyola goes down to Aberdeen and gets a $45 or $50 ticket, does he want to take a whole day off of work just to go fight a ticket? So even if a judge would throw it out, he's not going to necessarily show up, pay the fine, and go on. It obviously is a problem. I think you hit on something with the terminology of the word reasonable and unreasonable. I believe this is a reasonable alternative for law enforcement. I believe law enforcement will approach this with reasonableness too. Again, they have to see somebody go through the stoplight. They have to see that, and they're going to be able to judge whether it was reasonable or not. And nobody coming, why ticket them? It's reasonable. And anyway, urge you to vote in favor of this bill. Thank you.
Further remarks on House Bill 1220. You're free to discuss.
Madam Chair, I would move we defer this to the 41st day.
Second. Moved by Lust, seconded by Hoffman. Remarks on that motion, Representative Lust. Anything further of the committee? Seeing none, we will vote on the Lust motion to defer House Bill 1220 to the 41st day. Those in favor say aye. Those opposed, no.
Representative Ingalls?
No.
Feinstein?
No.
Gibson? Gosch?
No.
Hamill?
Yeah.
Hoffman?
Aye.
Killer? Lust?
Aye.
Mosher?
Aye.
Schleckaway?
Aye.
Turbeville?
Aye.
Hunt?
Aye.
Cutler?
Aye.
8 ayes, 3 no, 2 excused.
And House Bill 1220 is deferred to the 41st day. Representative Feinstein, I think you'll find that had we deferred your bill, you actually would have had less time for discussion because of our bill deadline coming up than you did today. And thank you for bringing the bill forward as well. That certainly the discussion, which has been protracted over several committee hearings, has alerted the public to the defense that they may claim is there.
Well, and I thank you. And two members did show up again, so it sort of alleviated the concern I had. It wasn't a matter of who, it was a matter of the numbers.
Thank you. With that, we have completed our calendar this morning, and the chair entertains a motion to adjourn. Moved by Mosher, seconded by Hunt. Those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Are there any opposed? We are adjourned.